If you enjoy what you hear on Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons and want to be part of bringing others together to work for the common good and flourishing of your community, why not consider helping to bring the Q Conference experience to your town for one special night on October 26th?
Christians believe that culture making is taking the raw material that God has made, and we're rearranging material for human flourishing and human thriving as God defines it.
Q Commons is a special live event featuring great national thought leaders plus local ones too. In hosting a Q Commons event, you'll be part of unifying believers in your community, promoting dialogue on difficult but important issues, and encouraging action for the common good. Q Ideas can guide you on how to host a Q Commons event. We can provide technical support and coaching to help you put together an event in your city. To learn more, visit qcommons.com. Q Commons, a global event advancing local good.
Welcome to Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.
Q is about conversation.
If we're really concerned about ending poverty, we've got to be more concerned about creating justice.
Our cultural products as Christians need to both defy and resonate with the culture.
Now God's doing amazing things. His church is expanding. His church is growing.
It's not what's the purpose of my life. It's what is the purpose that's been assigned.
Stay curious. Think well. Advance good. This is Q.
Welcome to another edition of the Q Podcast. I'm Gabe Lyons, and I'm so excited for you to hear from our next guest. He's somebody who's been a friend of mine for many years. He's been a friend of the Q community. He's really an expert, not only because of his knowledge, but because he practices with his life, living out everything that he's talking about. His name's Jeremy Courtney. He lives with his family in Iraq, and whenever it comes to issues happening in the Middle East, which there has been no shortage of issues over the last decade, Jeremy's our on-the-ground go-to person to better understand what's really happening behind the headlines, beyond just the news. How can we better understand the situation, and how do we understand it from somebody who's literally in Iraq because their Christian faith called them to go move in amidst this community and be a part of renewing and restoring people's lives and helping them? It began with life-saving heart surgeries through his organization, Preemptive Love, and now that's carried over into doing so much work amongst refugees and being on the front lines as it relates to the battles that are taking place between ISIS and other forces. And they're right in the middle of this. So many of you have supported them, cared for them, helped them as they try to help people on the front lines. And so I'm excited for you to get to meet him if you haven't before and to just hear from him. And instead of a talk, we decided today we want to interview Jeremy because we really want you to just hear from him. We want this to be more real time to understand what are the dynamics right now, because we know every day they change on the ground in the Middle East. And so we want you to hear from somebody who can report back to us right away from what's taking place. So let's just jump in to my interview with Jeremy Courtney. Well, Jeremy, it is so great to talk to you. It always is. And where are you at today?
At home in Iraq.
We're seeing the news headlines. We understand that dramatic changes are happening on the battlefronts around ISIS strongholds in places like Mosul and other places. And I know for you, this isn't just news headlines. I mean, this is life. It's been life for many, many years. Catch us up just like right now. What's happening on the ground in some of these really difficult areas?
Well, right now we've got our time split between two major geographies, Iraq and Syria. On the emergency, urgent front, this active fight against ISIS, major combat operations have really wrapped up in the city of Mosul, which means the city of Mosul is effectively free of any real ISIS control. Now, this influence, there's the scars of war and long-lasting effects. But for weeks, we've been on the front lines with Iraqi security forces pushing into the old city where they, you know, had their last major holdout, and just trying to get in to the people who had been starving and needing help the most. So with that wrapped up now, we're trying to turn the corner in Mosul a little bit and really across much of Iraq and help people get back to work, back to jobs, back home, start rebuilding the city in a lot of ways. And then across the way in Syria, we've sort of turned our attention to the fight against ISIS there in the city of Raqqa, where people are undergoing the same kinds of things that we've been dealing with in Iraq, starvation and being used as human shields. And so we're trying to make sure that we get food and medical care and all that kind of stuff as close to the front lines as we can and help Syria rebuild.
Man, and I know it feels daunting for you guys because you're just in it every day. I hope there's some encouragement, just that there's some progress, that some good is happening. But I know it probably doesn't feel like that. I wonder if you would help our listeners who don't know the deep story of that goes back a decade, catch them up just a little bit on how did you end up with your family in Iraq?
I think 9/11 was the real catalyzing thing, as for many of us who are about my age, late 30s, early 40s, and maybe older, you know, 9/11 was such a cataclysmic event. Jessica and I were at that stage in life. We just graduated from college, just gotten married, and in many ways had our whole life in front of us, which meant we could make a lot of different decisions about which direction we would go. Ultimately, we decided to try and respond to 9/11 by moving into the neighborhood, so to speak, to try and address some of the concerns of global terrorism and this growing Christian versus Muslim divide, Islamism versus the West. We didn't know anything about Al-Qaeda, never heard of this guy Osama bin Laden before 9/11. Ultimately, that landed us over the course of some years in Iraq, in the middle of the Iraq War, where I was just minding my own business, working on my laptop in a hotel cafe. And this guy approached me and asked me if I could help his little cousin get a life-saving surgery. I tried to hold the family at arm's length, really tried not to engage, but ultimately got roped into by his charm. And as we sought to engage and help that one family, kids just started coming out of the woodwork who needed these life-saving surgeries. And one thing led to another, and we started just helping kind of one at a time more and more until it became clear that we needed to make a decision. And out of that, the Preemptive Love Coalition was born.
Well, I love this story because I think even for our listeners to understand, it's one of you guys deciding to show up. It's not necessarily what you were thinking about or something you even had any skill in, but you just go, I got to do something. We're going to help this one person. And I don't know if it'll lead to anything or an organization or 10 years later what you're doing right now, but you were just faithful for the one thing God put in front of you after doing years of these heart surgeries, helping children, just faithfully serving, living in the community, building relationships with people of other faiths and specifically the Islamic faith, to then years later when this crisis in the last couple of years begins of ISIS, you're positioned to be able to respond. And what do? You guys respond again. What is it about your faith that has motivated you to respond in that kind of a way?
But I think it's important to note that I responded to the man in the cafe somewhat reluctantly. I actually tried to beg off the whole thing. But because in many ways, the girl, the little child who needed surgery was a bit of an abstraction still. She wasn't there. She wasn't in front of me. She was someone else's problems. But when she showed up, when dad brought her to the cafe and she sat down, now this is a real person. It just becomes very, very difficult to turn away real people in need. And I think that this sort of typifies some of the moment that we're in right now where so many of our ideas about each other are just abstractions. We're not as connected as we could be to people on the other side of an issue or on the other side of the ocean or the other side of a religion or political party or whatever. And in as much as these things remain abstractions to us, it's very easy to try and hold people at arm's length or to even take pot shots at people. But when somehow they come through the doors and sit down across from you and you're faced with actually engaging or rejecting a real flesh and blood person made in the image of God sitting across from you, it seems, in my experience, the whole calculus just changes. I find it very, very difficult to reject people who are right in front of me.
Yeah. And I think by responding, it changes how you view people. The perceptions start to melt away and you really treat people as made in the image of God. Now, you and Jess, over the last few years, your mission almost changed. Now you've had to respond to refugees coming into Iraq, trying to just get food for themselves or their children. And it's radically shifted how much you've had to intensely focus on that urgent need of adults and children. Catch us up on the work you've been doing the last couple of years on that front, and even bring us all the way up to today. Like, what's that looking like?
Yeah, in response to that one little girl in the hotel, we really became a medical organization. That's where everything started, was providing these life-saving surgeries. But with the rise of ISIS in 2014 And with the Syrian civil war, everything just converged in this boiling over in 2014 for us, where we had millions of Iraqis displaced. As we started to respond to Iraqis from all over the country who were being driven from their homes by ISIS, we really didn't have a strategy, but we didn't have much of a choice either. I mean, these were our neighbors, these were our friends, these were the people that we had committed ourselves to, now in need of every imaginable thing to stay alive. And so we just started going toward them as they were kind of running away from the bombs and the bullets and ISIS. We started trying to figure out ways to get closer in to the need. As we've learned the ropes of that a little bit, then it's accelerated our work. And so I think what we realize now is that we have to maintain this two-pronged approach. We have to show up on the front lines when people are starving and in need of every imaginable thing to live. Someone's got to actually go into the conflict, go into the violence to reach them. We can't just sit on the sidelines and say, hey, suffering people, we're out here. If you can make it to us, we'll be here to help you. That's not what the humanitarian imperative is. It's not what the gospel imperative is. We've got to be willing to go in toward them and put our lives on the line to reach them. But beyond just food and water and medicine and things like that, we really have to take a long view of what's needed in places like Syria and Iraq. We got to help people get back to work. We got to jumpstart economies, and we have to do it all with a vision of reconciliation in mind. And so we make sure that our teams are Muslim and Christian and Kurdish and Arab and Yazidi and Sunni and Shia. And we just try to build in as much harmony as we can so that reconciliation is something we do as we go. And it's not just some seminar that we start thinking about some years down the road.
As you guys have gotten creative to solve some of these problems, I know you found some really interesting ways to help educate people around the world to participate. I love one of the things you guys did on the SOAP project, how it created like innovation for people on the ground there to have work to do, but it also created these great products that people here in the States are able to use in a way of supporting. Will you just tell us a little bit about how that idea came about?
One of the great exports and regional products of our area is Syrian soap, specifically soap made out of the city of Aleppo. And as Aleppo came under siege for so long and was ultimately destroyed, the Syrian soap makers really got dispersed, and a lot of Syrian soap making was put on hold for a while. And so Jessica started investigating, how can we help Syrian refugees get back to work? And for a couple of years, we weren't very savvy enough to figure it out. It was really as the debate in America about refugees was starting to boil over. Should we let them in? Should we not? Are they safe? Are they not? Jessica just really wanted to distill her heart, our heart, down into this idea that we really belong to each other. Again, once you can sit down across the table from someone, you actually really believe that this is just like your sister or just like your brother. And so she started this line called Sisterhood, which has now allowed her to work with displaced women and men from across these countries to create soap and now expand the line into handmade candles and some other handmade products as well, being made by Syrians and Iraqis. And it's just been a beautiful message and a beautiful set of really excellent products that are all pure, all natural soap and wonderful hand-poured candles and hand-knit things by Syrian women. And so it's just been a really amazing thing to watch. We started a men's line as well called Kinsmen. And so whether on the kinsman side or the sisterhood side, to just gather around this idea and really embrace this reality that these are people made in the image of God. These are our kinsmen. These are our brothers, our sisters, and we should care for each other as such.
One of the things, Jeremy, we've talked a lot about how this experience for you personally as a Christian has shaped the way that you interact with what we could refer to as the other, just somebody who's different than us, could be different beliefs and religion, different ethnicity, different gender. The fact that there's somebody just different than us, different experience, they're coming from a different place. You've had to learn to interact with that because in many cases in Iraq, you're a minority. You're not the one who shows up in the majority culture. You're white. You're not practicing the dominant faith of your culture. Would you just talk a little bit about how that's shaping you?
Yeah, it's weird. And I think I'm just starting to understand it a little bit more over the last couple of years. But I find myself maybe playing a bit of a translator role now between cultures, because obviously whenever I'm home like America, where my extended family is, the culture I grew up in, and I'm what would be called privileged. I mean, I am the dominant in every way, male, Christian, white, evangelical, whatever. But where I live and have actively lived and spent my career this past nearly 15 years has been in places like Iraq and other countries surrounding here, where I was the minority, like you said. And so I think to go through my daily life on some level viewed with suspicion, to be the outsider, to be disadvantaged linguistically and handicapped in some other ways. And even that is not, I mean, I still enjoy a certain status of power as an American, and I enjoy a certain status as a wealthy person or someone bringing aid. So I don't mean to say that I'm some martyr here, but it's made me more empathic, I think. It's made me more aware of what it feels like to have some handicap, at least. I didn't have a lot of handicaps growing up, and at least now I recognize that I have some handicaps. And so I'm trying to learn how to leverage those experiences to come back and be an advocate, an ally, a friend in conversations in the States, predominantly among people like me who have never experienced or actively understood any handicaps in their own life, and to try and advocate on behalf of those who feel severely disadvantaged and have experienced life from a very oppressed or at least disadvantaged place, even in our American culture. I honestly don't think I'm very far down the road on this yet. I think I'm just learning how some of this last decade plus on this side of the world can now be leveraged to be a better friend on the American side of the world.
Yeah, that's great. Well, talk specifically too, though, about the Muslim-Christian dynamic, because I know that's something you've been able to, for years now, have very interpersonal relationships and contact and actually work together with those who have different beliefs. And that's just become common for you. And I know for so many people in the relief and development world, that has been very normal. And yet in American life for people, that's not always common, that they would have a friend who's a Muslim and who is following a different faith. And sometimes even in American news headlines, you can start to see how there's a fear of Muslims and a look at Islam that's not always fair to the people who practice that faith. And so I'm just curious, though, as you've lived this out, how would you encourage Christians in a place like America to think about their Muslim neighbors and friends and how to encounter them maybe differently than what the news headlines or the fear-mongering can sometimes create?
I went out into the world post 9/11 believing that I was on a completely different path than my soldier friends who responded to 9/11 with a posture that said, basically, we want to turn Afghanistan into a parking lot. We want to blow Iraq back to the Stone Ages, ultimately, is kind of where the conversation went. And I fancied myself as someone who was not like that, not a conqueror, not a destroyer. And then I ended up in this part of the world, and I was very adept at turning every single conversation with a Muslim into a fight. No matter what the Muslim responded with or what the Muslim led with, I was going to be the kind of ardent defender of Jesus that knew how to turn everything into a fight. And so the Muslim might tell me, we both worship one God, and I would throw a right hook, proverbially, you know, rhetorically, and turn it into a fight and say, no, we don't worship the same God. And he would say, yes, we do. And he would say, I'm a follower of Jesus. And I'd throw a left hook and say, here's why you're wrong, or here's why we're different. And Muslim after Muslim after Muslim for 15 years has been reaching out to me and trying to at least establish relationship, establish some common ground by saying how much we are alike. And for years, all I wanted to do was spar and try and insist first on how different we were. And I had a profound experience one day early on at a conference in prayer, and I was just crying out to God saying, where are you? What are you doing? I've been here for years now trying to tell people about Jesus, and you're just nowhere. You're nowhere to be found in this. And probably the one time in my life I would say God spoke to me, I think what I heard back from God was, because you don't love them. What I took that to mean is, you don't and have never loved Muhammad, the Muslim, sitting on the other side of the coffee table from you. You only love Muhammad, the former Muslim, that you get a notch in your belt because you made him not a Muslim anymore. You only love Muhammad, the guy that, you know, you could see him becoming somewhere down the road, but not the guy in front of you. And I understood that to mean that I was actually every bit the conqueror that a lot of my friends who had gone off to war were. I wanted to destroy Muslims too. I wanted to destroy so much of everything they stood for and everything they held dear, and I wanted to make them like me. With my face down in prayer at that conference, I saw myself screaming out to God with my fist up, looking for a fight. And when that word came, because you don't love them, I saw my fist lower in my mind's eye praying and my arms open up. And I stood up from that prayer, a completely changed person in the real world. Really now for the last 12, 13 years, I've never gotten into another one of those sparring matches, as I've just learned to try and not love the reflection of myself that I see in them or that I want to see in them, but to try and meet them where they are and start there and see where the relationship goes and not be so quick to drive toward distinction, but to be patient and allow some common ground to be, you know, established between us.
Yeah. Have you found that to be pretty simple as time goes forward, that the common ground just kind of emerges and there's really are some great things to come together on and work together on?
Yeah, and I don't even think it takes time, honestly. I mean, unless you're dealing with an extremist, like a true, true extremist, common ground is so readily available between us and Muslims. I think a lot of us have been brought up, or at least the strain that I grew up in, espoused a certain vision or version of evangelism that was afraid of common ground on some level and wanted to drive so quickly toward distinction. I think what we do is we don't approach a lot of our friendships with Muslims the way we approach relationship with our spouse. You know, I mean, when I was pursuing Jessica, I wanted to bury every distinction between us and just focus on the things that we had in common. I wanted all the ways that I was quirky or different to be saved for a later day for another conversation once we had some good ground between us.
Right.
But we don't do that a lot of times when dealing with the other. You know, we focus only on the things that are different, and we forget to even allow some commonalities to flourish.
Yeah, that's great insight. And I think for those listening, what a great thing to take away is just the ability to focus on what we have in common and get to know one another and not let the barriers pop up, because God's called us into relationship with every single human being made in his image. And the more we can take that approach, as Jeremy has done, I think it helps us have the opportunity to get to know people, to truly have an authentic relationship that God can use and steer in the direction that he wants to take it. But Jeremy, I'm just so thankful for your work. And so thank you on behalf of just everybody listening for being there on the front lines when many of us feel helpless and there's not much we can do. We can do. We can help you. We can support your work. And I invite you to just share with people where they can learn more, how they can get involved. What is it that you're asking people to do right now?
The biggest thing that the people of Iraq, Syria, Yemen need right now is they need us to keep showing up for them, even though the headline news is going to move on. We've been, as a culture, pretty much obsessed with ISIS. They have to go on even when our news cameras turn off and go home. And so when we declare victory over ISIS in Mosul or soon in Raqqa, the U.S. is going to lose a lot of interest in this. And so we're asking people to sign up to be monthly sponsors that we can project out month after month after month. How can we keep showing up for people? How many homes can we plan on rebuilding 3 months from now for people who have not had a shred of income for 3 years? How can we get food to the front lines for people who are still starving in this other place over here that's not, you know, receiving any media attention? So monthly sponsorships, no matter what the dollar amount is just so huge for us right now, because it allows us to get some visibility for what we can keep doing for people on the front lines and for many, many tomorrows from today onward.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you for your time and for continuing to do this great work, Jeremy. It's always great to hear the update. We're praying for you, and we'll continue to support all that you're doing.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate you guys.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing straight from Jeremy what's happening. He's such a great man. He's intelligent. He understands the issues. He understands the dynamics that are sometimes really hard to understand when you live in a world that's very interested in just a headline. You find with Jeremy in that conversation, you just start to see, man, this is complex. There's a lot happening, and there's a lot we can learn. There's a lot we can learn from not only what it means to show up in the most difficult of situations and to have our families in the midst of that and to have courage to just practice that faithfulness. But then also, what does it mean to work with people who think differently, who don't share your same beliefs? But you have to work together to do good. And I think in our world today, few people understand how to do that. And I think we just learn a lot from hearing how Jeremy does that, how he thinks about it. So I hope this has been encouraging to you. If it has, please share it with other friends. This community around Q and the podcast just continues to grow, but it's because of people like you who share these with your friends and others you know that might be interested in this and understand these topics better and meet people like Jeremy. I'd also encourage you to go to the Preemptive Love Coalition's website at preemptivelove.org, where you can learn much more about their organization. You can see ways you can participate. You can even give and support and get involved in the many programs and ways in which they have to serve the people who are in the most dire of need. I hope you'll check that out. I hope you'll learn more about that and think about it. And as you start to make your plans for next year, put down on your calendar April 11 to 13, 2018 in Nashville will be Q2018. We're already starting to gear up for it. We're already working through presentations and topics. Jeremy's somebody who's consistently a part of that community on panels and helping educate us. But you'll meet so many other thoughtful people like Jeremy, but you'll also be learning together with your friends, with your team. And so we invite you to learn more about that at qideas.org/2018. This show is made possible in partnership with Faith Radio and Northwestern Media.
Thank you for listening to the Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thank you for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.